Once again, everybody, another crazy week of technology news. Huge events the last couple weeks, continuing into September.
Nothing. No, Brian, nothing earth-shattering this week.
Really? Google didn't buy WebOS or Tim Cook and printers? Or
no, not really. Oh.
This is Tech Bacon, a weekly conversation about the latest in technology, new media,
and random foodstuffs. We're your hosts. I'm Scott Gold.
I'm Brian Bishop, and this is episode number
28.
It's an early morning show, everybody, here on a September 4th, 2011 for Tech Bacon. Welcome.
This is going to be interesting.
Yeah, we're starting earlier than usual and
earlier than ever.
We'll cut this. We had some problems with the opening segment this morning, but we'll just cut that out. You don't have to hear that, really.
No, unless you happen to be listening live, then you're up early with us.
Yeah.
So you had some enjoyment.
Yeah. And if you're up this early, then, you know, then you don't, you're out of it as well and don't remember.
Although, like, you know, across the country, it's not as early as it is here. So
this is true.
There are people up and about and maybe listening to us.
Indeed. Indeed, sir.
So let's get this ball rolling.
Exactly. Got a lot of cool stuff, you know, on deck today. We got some, you know, stuff from more stuff in the Amazon tablet. Got some stuff about, you know, Netflix moves, some Apple stuff, yeah. iPhone. But yeah, actually, let's start with that Amazon tablet stuff. You want to kick it off?
Sure. It was TechCrunch, I think.
Yeah, MG Siegler.
Yeah, got some hands-on time with what is going to be the new Amazon tablet.
Yeah.
Pretty much everything Brian and I have been predicting and wanting seems to be the case with this new tablet, right?
Yeah, which they're going to call just the Amazon Kindle. It's not going to be called the Kindle Touch
Color
or
anything like that, which is smart, I think.
Yeah, we're just kind of making it one big line. I mean, it's very Apple-esque, but it's very smart. They're just building on their pre-existing brand, not differentiating it, you know, via name. Just
right.
Making it,
just, this is the next Kindle.
Yeah, you like your Kindle before, you'll like this new Kindle even better.
Yeah, so it seems like it's going to be a 7-inch device.
Correct.
Same form factor as the PlayBook.
Right. He said the feel of it on the back as it has. We'll get to that in a second.
Okay, but isn't that the same? Isn't that what size? The
I think it's
is?
A 7-inch as well. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, and the Galaxy Tab, there was a 7-inch.
Yeah. There's been a number of 7-inch devices.
So that
yeah.
form factor.
Exactly. Not going against the iPad, you know, head to head, which is a 9.7, you know, device, obviously.
Right. I think the biggest thing is that it's a completely customized fork of the Android OS.
Yeah. And not only fork on top of a fork from Honeycomb, fork from maybe earlier than, you know,
they're
2.3.
They're saying probably 2.3-ish
yeah.
time frame,
yeah.
Which is great. And also, once again, not to toot our own horns here, but something Brian and I did predict or wish would happen.
Yeah.
We talked about this. We're like, wouldn't it be great if they actually did their own OS, which is what they're doing.
It makes a lot of sense. And I mean, we'll get to this in a second, but it's the big threat to Google that Google has enabled with Android. But we'll get to that in a second.
True.
Basically the device is supposed to be kind of like, you know, that 7-inch form factor, rubberized back like the PlayBook.
Mm-hmm.
And the OS, it sounds really interesting. If you hold it, you know, portrait mode, there's a carousel and there's a dock on the bottom. That makes you go to like scroll through your media and your apps and that kind of stuff, which is very smart. Different interface we've seen,
right.
You know, recently.
And much
other devices.
Simpler.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, what this perfect is what they this is what they need to be doing.
Yeah. However, it is going to go and have it is going to have full access to the
Amazon
App Store. Correct.
Amazon App Store, not the Google App Store, though.
Correct.
Only Amazon.
And that's what's really interesting about this. It's not going to have, you know, access to any special, you know, of the Google applications or any of the proprietary, you know, marketplace, the maps, any of that stuff. It's going to be its own thing completely.
I do wonder though if they'll end up having Google Search as part of it.
Never.
Because what are they going to do? Have Bing?
Well, actually, you know what? I think the browser did have Google Search in it. But that
you know
was,
what I mean?
But that wasn't like – it wasn't on the homepage. It wasn't like a system feature. It was just like a browser and the browser needs a search. And they went with, you know, Google versus Bing.
Right. I mean, and as far as like – are they even going to put a maps program on there? Like what do you – why?
They probably don't need one.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like what – it's not necessary for this device.
Yeah.
I don't think.
Good point.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, because basically it's going to be, you know, organized around, you know, consuming media, you know, books from Amazon, you know, movies from Amazon.
It's going to have there are rumors that it may, you know, include a free Amazon Prime subscription, which has all the instant streaming that Amazon has.
As well as, you know, free 2-day shipping for all their, you know, all the physical products.
And the music app is going to be the Amazon MP3 app,
uh-huh.
The current Android one, which makes complete sense.
Definitely.
That has your cloud music and your, you know, the onboard, you know, songs.
Yeah. And what's really, really interesting about this to me, I think, is, you know, when Google released Android, it was kind of like this open source, you know, they've touted, you know, how open source it is for, you know, years now. And that's been like, you know, a big PR benefit to them. But they've always kind of, you know, played things close to the vest in terms of their own apps and basically encouraged, you know, hardware manufacturers to keep their stuff on board, because that's the way Google, you know, is able to monetize the device, right? Mm-hmm. Through search, you know, mm-hmm. through selling mm-hmm. ads. And without their search, without their, you know, without Gmail, without all their stuff, they can't collect data nor serve ads. They're not really making any money on the devices. Right. And what Amazon has done, it's, you know, it's very clever. They've taken the core OS and basically, you know, use that to what, you know, make what they want. And they're kind of cutting Google out completely. So Google won't be making any money off these devices, really.
No.
You know, other than like, you know, normal Google search, which is, you know, anybody can do from a web browser.
Right.
And so in a weird way, the question is, what happens if this takes off? Because truth be told, I mean, Honeycomb has not done that well. There was a report out earlier, you know, a couple of days ago that though Samsung may have shipped 1 million Galaxy Tabs, they may have sold as little as 20,000 of them, which is nuts.
Hmm. That's interesting.
And if that's true, you know, they haven't really kind of, you know, there's no big competitor. There's no number two to the iPad yet, right? This looks like it could truly be that device. Now, what happens then to, you know, Google's Android ambitions then in the tablet space? Do they get completely shut out at that point? What happens?
I'm curious in the tablet space, definitely. Because if you think about it, the obviously a company like Amazon can spend the money to develop their own OS, and other bigger companies can do that. But smaller companies, or just companies that don't want to put that money into it, that's when an OS like the Google version of Honeycomb mm-hmm. or of Ice Cream Sandwich coming up makes sense. You know, it makes sense for a developer that doesn't want to put huge, huge resources into basically creating their own OS.
Sure.
You know, and that's when it makes sense. You know, if a company like Asus doesn't want to develop an OS, then obviously it totally benefits them to have Google be creating this OS and they don't have to put any money into it. You know?
Definitely. Now, and here's another thing that's kind of, you know, flows out of this that we were talking about on Friday. If Amazon does, you know, take over, becomes the number two tablet maker next mm-hmm. to the iPad, right?
Which I think is a very likely scenario.
Yeah, I agree. And Google finds themselves in this position where they are not making any money in that space. Chromebooks aren't taking off, whatever, right? Do they simply go and say, okay, we need to go and have an entrant in here because this is the future of computing? Is this where the Motorola acquisition comes into play? And do we see a Google Motorola, you know, branded tablet?
I think that happens. Absolutely. That absolutely happens.
Yeah.
First of all, it would be dumb for them not to now that they have Motorola will have Motorola. And it just makes perfect sense. And they're going to be grasping a little bit, I think, to really get a foothold into the tablet market. Although at the end of the day, maybe they don't want to. Maybe they really want to put – and they haven't shown this and they have been so separate. But maybe they're going to, you know, kind of combine everything into the Chromebook field and go – full force on that. I haven't seen anything to say that they're doing either, but it's like maybe they'll actually merge those two divisions together.
Possibly. Chromebook seems so niche-y. I could see the Chromebook, you know, getting real legs 5 years down the line. You know what I mean? When, you know, browsers are basically more capable, have more direct access to hardware. A lot of the stuff that we're, you know, see these initiatives starting now that aren't going to, you know, pay dividends till a few years
down the
line.
But it's like, why not take the Chromebook concept and actually, you know, have full-on Android on there? It's this, I mean, you know. Why not? They're kind of building it that they haven't done any of this, but they can very easily if they wanted to.
They're two different philosophies. You know, they're very, very different approaches to product, basically. You know, you have basically with Android the notion that, you know, specific, you know, software OS running on, you know, a specific device, you know, basically incorporating, you know, native apps, that kind of stuff. It's a very, very different approach to basically saying,
oh, sure,
we're going to go and have, you know, hardware is irrelevant. It's all in the browser. It's all in the cloud.
Right.
Those things really don't matter. They're two very, very, you know, they're opposite ends of the spectrum, really. And I don't think you can really merge those. You have to decide you're going to go one way or the other. Google is obviously pursuing both simultaneously, but with different types of products.
Right. I mean, I think there's a way. If they wanted to, I think there's a way they could merge those two things. They haven't, and they haven't shown any interest in it. But I think you could. I think the Chromebook concept is flawed, and I don't think it's going to work. And I think in order for them to get what they really want, they're going to have to bring in more of the Android type features.
Yeah, it's hard. I think my big problem with Chromebooks, I feel like it may be premature still, except for very, very certain specific niche enterprise markets.
Yeah.
You know, I think what they need to do is, I mean, they need to go and heavily encourage the browser-based, you know, system, that whole philosophy within Android and not the other way around.
That's the problem, though, is like the cloud-based thing makes sense, but having everything be a browser-based interface doesn't. Having working everything in just a browser window, I think it's flawed.
Well, it becomes...
You know what I mean? Like having everything in the cloud and having web-based apps and all that stuff, great, but not in the traditional browser window.
Well, it's like they need something where they can go full frame with it, and it becomes, you know, the Chrome disappears, basically. Because on the Chromebook, you still see...
You're in a web browser. It's just a browser.
Browser Chrome, right?
It's, yeah.
And you're not viewing it. You're not seeing, like, the page in full frame.
You can
still
go full frame for a couple of things, but no.
That's how it has to be. It has to be transparent for the user to
that's
really
what I mean.
Take
like,
off. Yeah.
To feel like you're always in a web browser...
Is ridiculous. Or just, is this not...
It's disconcerting a little bit
it's not
when
ridiculous.
You're working.
It's an interesting concept, but it's, I don't think it's going to take off for the average consumer.
That, yeah, that's what I mean. And that's kind of more what I'm saying as opposed to merging with Android, but more of a, you know, just different...
Yeah, and it is weird for them to be, you know, pursuing both strategies simultaneously, because it does kind of give you the impression that they're not really sure that it's time for the Chromebook yet, or they're not really sure which, you know, which they want to focus on. Which is very different than, you know, other companies. You know, Windows is betting it all on Windows 8 with like a unified OS. Mm-hmm. Apple's obviously betting it all with, you know, we're saying no, web-based is not the way to go. We think it's, you know, device-based.
Right.
But it is interesting. But here's my other question to you. Okay. Amazon tablets out there, iPads out there. Google says, you know what, we need to go.
By the way, also just quick note on Amazon tablet, we're talking like $250 price most likely.
Yeah, well, we'll get back to the rest of it. Yeah, we got to get off the tangent, get back to the rest of the details. No. What happens, do you think, if Google and Motorola come out with a special, you know, tablet that's more in the vein of this Amazon offering and the iPad, where basically it's like it's this one great thing, it's all in one, it's integrated. They get their music thing sorted out, they get their movies thing sorted out, mm-hmm. they get the books thing mm-hmm. up. Mm-hmm. And they do
like
that.
Like a Google Media device?
Yeah. How does that affect the relationship with the other Android OEMs?
I don't know. I'm curious.
You know, because I think at that point it becomes a very, very different dynamic with them.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, the only time it becomes a problem, and this may happen, this may not, is if they give Motorola features that they will not allow other manufacturers to have. That's when it becomes an issue.
I think
otherwise it's not an issue because it benefits all of them, because they can have all these awesome features that, but as soon as they start limiting other people from using certain features to push their own product, then the other manufacturers are going to get pissed.
I think it's more of a complex situation than that, because if you have the Google OS and you have the Google sanctioned device, that will always take, you know, people will always give that device, you know, more, you know, credence in the marketplace than another company. It's kind of like
already done it, and it's not.
But no, they've never directly – they had the Nexus. That wasn't quite the same thing, because other people made that. If they have their own thing that they make, it's kind of like, you know
– But like the average consumer didn't know that. Like when the Nexus came out, it was the Google phone, and it was – you bought it on Google.com and you like
– And it never actually competed in the market with the other – you know, with the other phones. And that's what I'm saying the problem is with them here, because if you have, you know, the Google tablet –
But you could buy it at Best Buy and stuff too.
But it wasn't –
The Nexus. It was available in those stores.
The very first one?
Yeah.
It was available only online.
The
first one, I think, was only online.
At first it was, but then it eventually was in the stores.
But that was already after it kind of petered out and kind of lost its mojo, I felt
right.
like.
Maybe.
But if you basically have the Google tablet and it's competing against, you know, a tablet by Samsung or something, people are always going to go to the Google tablet because that's the bigger brand. That's the, you know, people like that brand. You know, that's
maybe
the selling point of the OS. You know, and it's interesting, like Microsoft, you know, made the software. It was a kind of a similar model, right? Where they never competed directly on hardware with their other OEMs, except for the Zune, right? And the Zune came out as a different MP3 player. They ditched plays for sure. And what happened? You know, that was a good device and everything else kind of faded into the background. It didn't actually help them against
the
iPod.
Anybody.
but you know, it's like, so it's interesting. I don't, because if you're Samsung, right, what do you do? If Google comes out with their own thing, it's going to be hard to compete against Google using Google's own OS.
Well, maybe you do what Amazon's doing if you're Samsung.
Yeah.
And I guess.
And then the problem becomes too, then what happens? What stops Google from just closing down Android, right?
Yeah. No, they could at some point if they wanted to.
It's very interesting, like what's going to happen the next couple of years with this thing. Like Amazon's really kind of, put a flag in the ground, and I don't know how they're going to respond moving forward, because it kind of forces Google to go and go against the nature they've been operating on.
They're not the first ones to do it, though. You know, I think it was Motorola, actually, funny enough, on the phone side, mm-hmm. ditched Google Search and Gmail on a couple of their phones like 2 years ago.
Oh, you're right. And they were going to use Motorola.
Bing.
And Motorola replaced was it with Bing. And they were going to use Skyhook as well. And there's that whole and that's the whole lawsuit is arising.
I mean,
it did.
They did do that. So it's not. I mean, it wasn't hugely successful. I don't think. But
right,
they did do that. So and I think there's a couple other phones out there that have they haven't ditched the Android market.
Right.
But the search and the maps have been taken away. So I think they must be prepared for people to be doing that.
Well, it's one thing to go, like you said, it's one thing to go and get rid of, like, you know, an app here or an app there and have other products in your lineup that do use it. Yeah. But it's one thing to say, like, this is our flagship product. It's our only product. What? It's going to be successful.
Yeah.
And you are shut out basically completely. It's kind of like, you know, releasing a device based on Linux, right? Linux gets no love from the normal consumer when they go and, you know, have that device, right?
Right. Right, right.
Yeah, so it's going to be very, very interesting. And going back to the device, like you said, it's going to be $250. It's going to be coming out, you know, October or November, right?
Soon. Well, I got a feeling – well, we'll talk about more. I got a feeling they're going to try and maybe push it now.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see. Well, I don't think – I think that, you know, the fact that – I think this is part of them building the hype. I mean, giving it to somebody, you know, at TechCrunch like that, you know, like Siegler, who's a big Apple proponent in particular, him going and giving it a positive review like that is very, very good for them in terms of starting to build that buzz.
Yeah. Well, and so, I mean, what also about the device – multi-touch screen.
Yeah, it's not – it's a capacitive multi-touch screen. It's like we thought, or, you know, we'd read earlier where it's not like a, you know, a 10-point multi-touch. It's like a, you know, two or three, something like that. Yeah.
Which makes sense. They're also full color screen, obviously.
Exactly. It's no ink involved, which is what the Kindle uses now. And also there's going to be – originally they were planning to launch a 7 and a 10-inch device. They're actually just going for the 7-inch now. The 10-inch is coming next year sometime.
And 7 inches is pretty much the size actually, not pretty much. It is the size of the Nook Color.
Right.
The same form as that,
and right now it's, you know, it's basically going against the Nook Color, both in terms of price, form factor, that kind of stuff. But it has that huge, you know, muscle of Amazon behind it.
By the way, speaking of the Nook Color has their own Android system on it too. By the way,
exactly,
they've done the same thing. I mean, not as good as this sounds, right. And I've played with Nook Color; it's fine, it's nice. But same thing, their own OS running.
Very, very interesting.
Yeah, I think it makes sense for a limited tablet experience.
Right.
I mean, I guess this isn't, it's not limited, but different, you know, but for the full fledged, like you would have to do major development to have like a full different OS, like that company, Garage.
Oh, the new Juju. And
which that's what they did. Their OS is the kernel of Android,
right,
but completely redesigned.
And just to go on a quick tangent, I think it really, the fact that this is coming out, you know, with this kind of setup and everybody kind of, you know, takes it for granted that it's going to be so successful, I think it really speaks to how Google Amazon dropped the ball a little bit, though, with Honeycomb. Like, they had a huge opportunity to come out with a great interface, a ton of people putting out hardware, and really go and do something, you know, positive in the marketplace for, you know, for Android. And I feel like even though they brought in people to help develop that, they really kind of, you know, I feel like it was a big letdown.
I really think it goes back to what you and I have talked about a lot of being – it's not a tablet market, at least not yet. It's an iPad market, just like the iPod. You know, we've talked about that in the past.
Yeah.
What is it that people want? When people buy a music player, they were not in the past, and this is just in the past, but also it seems like that's what's going on with the iPad, and we've discussed this, is they wanted an iPod. It wasn't about wanting an MP3 player. That wasn't what it was about. It was about wanting an iPod, and it seems like that's what it is now. It seems like it's wanting an iPad. It's not about a tablet.
Well, I think you're exactly right, because what we're talking about now is basically not computers per se. They are computers, but we're talking about consumer electronic devices. Right. Apple's done a great job at saying you want an iPad for this, for reading, for, you know, FaceTiming with your family, for medical devices, all this kind of stuff, right? They've done a great job of that. This is, you know, Amazon doing something very, very smart and similar. It's not competing with the iPad.
No, it's
smaller
a Kindle
form factor. It's a Kindle.
It's, do you want a Kindle?
Yeah, it's about, you know, it's about
it's
reading.
Not, do you want another
it's about,
tablet?
You know, movies. It's about that kind of stuff. You know, easy to use, all that kind of stuff. Specific use. Why would people buy a Honeycomb tablet? You know, and the same thing with the Windows 7 tablet, which, you know, there's more coming out on the market now already. I mean, even though they have the Windows 8 stuff coming up next year,
right?
You know, what is the point? Why would you buy those things? Like, what is the use case?
I mean, there's really not, the difference is pretty minimal.
Yeah. And nothing's been explained.
And nothing's better.
Yeah.
At the end of the day. I mean, I like the Galaxy Tab. I love it. It's a great device. You put it up against the iPad. You're going to say this is a better device? No, absolutely not. So, you know.
Well, I think
What's the differentiating?
I think it's that comes back to that, you know, that, you know, if you want a if you want to go and do simple computing, not simple computing, but like the basic computing that most people do, email, web browsing, you know, that kind of stuff, with an interface that is easier, streamlined, and less hassle, then you go and get an iPad. You know, that was always my thing about Honeycomb. To learn Honeycomb seemed just as complex as, you know, learning a desktop computer. You know, there's no advantage to it versus the laptop you already own. You know, this new Kindle seems like, well, that's going to be fantastic. That's going to be way better for, you know, for reading or, you know, watching
and
movies
especially
and stuff
like,
than like my computer, right?
You know, they have their, you know, on the Kindle side, they have their built-in Kindle crowd.
Right.
And if you think about it, it's a perfect time for a lot of these people that got the first generation Kindles to be wanting to upgrade.
Right.
We've been a couple of years now.
Oh, and here's
one
thing.
It's like timing-wise is very smart.
One thing, it was unclear. It looked like it was going to be Wi-Fi only, didn't it?
That's what they said.
Which is very strange because WhisperNet and the 3G accessibility was always huge for me in the Kindle. That's one of the reasons I really, really love it.
But, you know, now it's like – I get why
they have to do it though because of, you know, movies, it's too much data.
Yeah.
You have to do
it. Yeah. Well, and also like if you think about it now that you can – you know, it's just so easy just to buy a book on your computer or buy it on your phone and then it's available on the – on
right.
the device when you know.
Well, I think most people, I'm sure they have data that supports this.
That
you
says
know,
the 3G is probably not used as much as.
As much as maybe
I
it was 2 years ago.
I guarantee you that.
Wi-Fi Nook, networks are so prevalent now.
I'm pretty sure the Nook is only Wi-Fi.
Is it?
Yeah. So maybe they came out with a 3G also, but I think when it first came out, it was the same kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, they have to because there's – and, you know, also they can't go and allow you to go and download books over 3G but not movies because then people go, why is – you have
right.
to worry about that.
Right.
And they don't want – you know, remove that. You know, consumers don't have to think about this stuff.
Exactly.
You know, they don't want to. They don't need to.
Exactly.
So it's really, really exciting. In a couple months, I mean, I know you're thinking about getting one when they launch, which
yeah.
I'm hoping for because I want to get my hands on it as soon
as
it
really
does.
Curious what the – reading experience is going to be for people who really like the e-ink, you know, because I do have to say, you know, I have that touchpad. And so I was doing some reading on it. I did find it a little hard on my eyes.
Yeah,
I actually did. And I was totally open to it. I wasn't even really thinking about it. I'm like, oh, cool. I get to read on this. And I was like, God, this actually affects me.
Yeah. They're very different
experiences. And I didn't realize.
Yeah, I have, excuse me. I have a Kindle and an iPad as well. And I've read books on both. And it is interesting because it's a very different experience. When you read it on an iPad or any kind of, you know, backlit screen, it is – you feel like you're using a computer. You can still get in bed and like it's cozy and whatnot, but it definitely is looking at a computer screen where you sit down with a Kindle, especially with – they have that great case with like the built-in light.
Yeah, yeah.
And it definitely feels more akin to reading a book. There's something about that where, you know, you're not having that bright light being shined in your eyes.
I do have to say I was at Best Buy the other day yesterday. I picked up one of the Nooks just to kind of see, and it actually, and I don't know what they did with the screen, but the reading on my eyes felt better than on when I was looking at the touchpad.
Right. Can you change the color of the paper
you
on
can.
The touchpad?
You can. So you can, it's the Kindle app, so you can
right.
do, you can make it sepia or
because that's right,
lighter.
You have
whatever.
To go and bring
makes
the
difference.
Bring
makes
the brightness
difference.
Down and like change the color of the paper because like that high contrast is blasting into your eyes is
yeah.
really, you know, bothersome. There were some studies, I think about a year ago in the, or maybe even longer when the first iPad came out that talked about physiologically what happens, like having that light in your eyes, like, you know, interrupts your body's, you know, basically it makes it harder for you to go to sleep. Because your body's used to it being, it seems like daylight to you. So where if you go and read a book, it's dimmer. It still feels like night. Even if you have like a book light.
Right, it's not shining in your eyes.
Yeah. So it helps you, you know, it doesn't prevent you from going to sleep. Because so many people, you know, read before going to bed, right?
Right, right.
And it would actually make them have, you know, less, you know, poor quality sleep by reading a backlit device.
That's interesting. You know, also, there were some rumors, nothing has been confirmed about them working on a dual e-ink display device.
Right,
which I think is the killer feature for a device like this.
Definitely,
I think Barnes & Noble and Amazon are probably working feverishly to come out with that.
Definitely,
because the first person out, and it's probably going to be Amazon, but the first person out of the gate with that just to switch to e-ink mode, it's brilliant.
Yeah,
it's brilliant. Or unless, I mean, maybe at some point color e-ink is going to be good enough to show movies and TV on. You know, then.
Yeah.
Yeah, that. But.
Yeah, and if you're not familiar with e-ink, it's basically that technology they use in the current Kindle where
and the Sony e-reader.
Yeah, and it's basically, and what's really interesting about it. Did we talk about this already? The power consumption?
No, I don't think we ever did. It's cool how it works.
It's really cool. Basically, what e-ink does is it there's this display and it has this it's basically it's kind of like a it kind of looks kind of sepia, right? And it has like the graphics on
there. Yeah, it's kind of like a grayish.
Yeah.
background.
And it basically, what happens is it goes and sends a current through the device and, you know, to put that image up, and then it stays static. It doesn't have to feed any energy to the device to go and keep that image up there. Right. It's like, it's basically on or off for these
that's
pixels,
why,
right?
I mean, that's why they call it e-ink, because it's little beads of a liquid, basically, that when this electroshock goes through it, and it's literally like a fraction of a second shock of electricity, it rearranges these little beads into what we see as type.
Yeah.
And like you said, then it takes no energy. Yeah, it's creating a new page of paper every time.
And every time it goes and, you know, changes that rearrangement, then it doesn't have to touch it again, which is why when you have your Kindle, you can put it into sleep mode and it can throw up a picture, you know, of an author or of a book cover.
Yeah, it doesn't take any energy.
Sit it there for weeks. And that's why it is so great at power consumption. And that's what I'm curious about too with the new Kindle. Supposedly around 10 hours battery life. That is surprising. I thought they were going to go for something a lot longer than that, because that's more or less what an iPad
But maybe
is.
They're saying 10 hours streaming movies. You know, we don't know what that 10 hours is. Right. 10 hours of what? If it's just reading, maybe it's a lot longer.
Right, that's true.
You know what I mean? Because we don't know.
Yeah, but I think 10 hours of usage is kind of, you know, if it's in line with other devices, and that is, you know, was it the tab? It's like seven.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
if it is 10 to 10, because that was the way they could have a huge advantage, I thought. They could go and really say, you know what? The iPad's great. It had 10 hours of battery life, which was revolutionary at the time, right? But we can go and beat that with 20.
Yeah.
And maybe they will. I don't think Siegler actually had, you know, played for it for 10 hours straight. Maybe they told him 10 and they're going to bust expectations that way.
But they do it like, you know, like you've always said with the iPod and iPad and the Apple ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
Amazon has an ecosystem now.
Yes.
They have books, movies, music. They have their own. You could stay within Amazon and do everything. And this device is the first device that is going to allow that, or is going to have that accessible. You're going to sign in with your Amazon account,
just
everything. Like you sign in with your Apple account.
Yep.
I mean, it's a very similar conceptual thing. So I'm sure images of this thing are going to start popping up pretty soon.
Yeah.
They're going to start there. This is the first step in the hype. They're going to start building it. They're going to really, you know, push forward, have some pre-orders and all that stuff. So
I agree. And also you talked about the 10-inch, you know, next year, that this tablet is a single core processor. Next year, the 10 is going to be a dual core.
Right.
But yeah, very, very exciting. And, you know, I think it's going to be the first real
competitive
successful entry, you know,
timing wise. Yeah. And holiday season right around the corner.
Perfect.
This thing could be the huge. And if you remember, the original Kindle, I believe, came out around the same time.
Yeah.
It was a holiday season thing, and it exploded.
Yep.
And I think this is because I remember I bought one of the Kindles on pre-order originally, and they sold out in like a day, those things. I mean, it was crazy. And I bought it just to play with it and then returned it, but, you know. Because I actually thought I might use it.
Scott likes to do that a lot.
No. I do not do that ever. I never do that. Who does that? What kind of people do that?
Playbook. Not the playbook.
I have an addiction. I have an addiction, man.
Time for an intervention.
tech intervention. That's going to be our new TV show.
It's going to be our new TV show, exactly.
Techvention.
We go into Scott's house and there's just piles and piles
of electronics.
He's like, I need to return those. I have a problem.
There's like a Commodore 64 sitting in the corner. It's like a combination of hoarders and intervention.
Dude, I'll buy that 64 off you. And do you have a classic? Do you have a Mac SE or SE30? I'll buy that off you too.
I got my Texas Instruments with the tape drive.
I want to play some Dark Castle on an old school Mac if you have one.
Nice.
Remember that?
Yes.
I love Dark Castle.
Leisure Suit Larry.
And
remember that? Did you ever play Leisure Suit Larry?
Oh yeah, many Sierra. I was a big fan of Sierra games. Do you remember Deja Vu?
Yes, I do.
Great, great detective noir on the original Mac. Fantastic game. Like one of the games that first like explored the possibility of a GUI interface. I love that thing. Oh. God. Deja Vu 2, Lost in Las Vegas, not as good, but the first one,
I don't
total
remember
classic.
That one
was in color, so several years later.
Right.
Oh, such good games.
So we'll see with the Amazon stuff coming soon, and I'm bound to end up with one. So
love it. Other interesting news, we've obviously talked about Netflix a lot and what their next moves are going to be moving forward. One significant development happened. It was announced on the day – well, this week was obviously when their price increase took a hold on September 1st, where basically they split up the streaming and the DVD services into separate offerings. The low-end ones cost $8 each. So if you had previously – like I think it was two or three – I think it was the three-disc this is the one disc, right? Was it the one disc was the $8? Yeah. If you had the one disc plus streaming offering that cost you $8, September 1st, it suddenly costs you $16, which a lot of people got, aggro about, I guess you could say, a couple months
people
ago.
People got really pissed about it. Still. Yeah. I heard people talking about it the other day.
Yeah. So that same day, on the first one that took hold, Starz announced that they were not going to be re-upping with Netflix because they wanted to go and they thought their content was more valuable and they were going to explore other options.
Right.
And as the current deal, I think, expires in February of 2012. So it was interesting. We had a conversation about this, you know, when it was announced. I thought it was a bit of, you know, negotiation posturing because obviously they're kind of coming, you know, they're going to, you know, going after each other. This puts the pressure publicly on Netflix. Netflix, you know, stock took a dive immediately thereafter. So there's a lot of content. It's interesting. There's a lot of, you know, first run content. Like you were saying, it's like Disney and what are the high end movies?
I was looking through the list and pretty much all of their high end movies, and not all, but a good majority of them come from the Starz catalog. It's like Sony, Disney, a couple other big studios, you know, and obviously Starz original content, which is a little bit of cool stuff, but nothing, you know,
right,
earth shattering. So, you know, pulling this catalog from their streaming, they got to re-up somehow because they lose their first run stuff.
Yeah. Well, it's funny too.
And it's so integrated too. It's like under the Starz tab in Netflix. I mean, it was a really strong partnership.
And this is funny because we talk about the first run movies. My impression of Starz on Netflix was always that it was the crappy offerings. You'd always get the movies that
is that too.
And yeah, it's like the movies they would be, you know, they weren't letterboxed. They were like, you know, full frame, like old VHS. And it was like always, you know, if there was,
totally.
My impression was that if there was a Jean-Claude Van Damme film that I really needed to see, it would be available on Netflix because of Starz.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
And so it was interesting. At first, this was a big news. Then Reed Hastings, CEO of Netflix, came back and said, basically said, that's, you know, we're really sad. It's been a great partnership. But, you know, thank you for letting us know ahead of time so we can go and replace all your content with better people at our own terms.
Right.
And then the LA Times the following day came out with a new piece that was really, really interesting, saying that Netflix had offered – the original deal was for $30 million. Netflix had offered Starz $300 million. And Starz wanted – a premium,
yeah, this was
for Netflix
weird.
Subscribers for access to their content. So basically, you would be paying $8 for streaming, but if you wanted access to Starz, you'd have to pay like 10 or 11 or something.
Yeah, that kind of blew me away. That's what they were asking for.
Which at that point, I'm like, good for Netflix. Like, that's ridiculous.
Absolutely.
You know, and I get Starz thinks, you know, they want to go. I'm sure it devalues their brand a lot in terms of, you know, that people like, you know, us think, oh yeah, it's the crappy movies on Starz.
Right.
You know.
I'm curious. I mean, I mean, Netflix is definitely coming off cool, calm, and collected, but I'm sure they are scrambling to replace that content because if that goes away and they don't replace it, the movies you get streaming on Netflix, you're very, 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 very limited, especially since they lost the Criterion collection. They lose this. You get TV streaming.
Yeah, well, I think what they have to do is what they already are planning on doing is going direct to the distributors. Like having middlemen great in terms of getting lots of content at once, especially earlier on, because I'm sure, you know, Warner's or Disney didn't want to deal with, you know, this little DVD company that had to want to do streaming.
Yes.
And now they can go, you know, direct and they can control their own fate better that way anyway.
Well, and that's the thing. Like Starz is not a content creator.
Right. Except for Spartacus, for the most part, this was
a partnership to use Starz existing licensing deals.
Right.
So Netflix didn't have to go to the studios individually and do their own licensing.
Right. Which is what Apple and everybody else has to do. Yeah.
Yeah. And it makes sense that Netflix should be doing that now anyway.
Yeah. Cause they're that big of a player. I mean, obviously.
Right. Now, but it does put them in a different competition segment now because Starz has these amazing licensing deals.
Sure.
HBO has these amazing licensing deals. Showtime has these deals and all of these people have exclusive rights to these movies at specific times.
Right. The HBO window has been
And these windows are pre-negotiated probably for a good chunk of time already.
Yeah. And many, many years ago. And that's the deal with these windows too. Most of these windows, we're talking about basically a movie comes out, right? And it's available only on HBO for 60 days or something like that.
Right.
All these were, you know, negotiated and conceived of before digital streaming was really available. So there's actually been arguments that are being made if these windows really apply to streaming to Netflix or streaming to an Apple TV or streaming to a Google TV.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because they're different mediums. You know, in a sense, they're not really like TV.
Right.
And I think as deals get re-upped, those are going to be special rights. They're going to be negotiated separately.
Oh, they're absolutely obviously to be negotiated separately. You know?
And so it is really interesting. We're in this like, kind of like transitionary period where everybody's like, oh, wait, this is all a new scary world. We can make more money off you guys. And then, you know, the Netflix is going, no, we're a viable distribution, you know, alternative unto ourselves so we can go negotiate directly.
Right. But no, you know, if you think about it, if Netflix was willing to spend $300 million for this catalog, That means they have $300 million to use to get their other deals.
Oh, yeah.
That's a lot of money.
Oh, yeah.
That's a lot of money. And it shows, it really does show that they're a major player. So now they start taking these meetings with the Disneys of the world, with Warner Brothers, with NBC Universal, with all of these content creators individually saying, we got money. Yeah. We got money. Let's make a deal.
Yeah. I think it was for $300 million for a year, not for like a
multi-year deal. That's what I mean.
Deal.
Yeah. So, it was, yeah. You know, so obviously Netflix is doing well.
And I can't help think that Starz is really, really overestimating the value of their offerings in this case. Because if you
– Well, I wonder, you know, like – yes. Yeah, I think, yes, they are a little bit. But I also think to – like from their mindset, it might be – they're not saying we're losing $300 million because they were never getting $300 million. They're saying we're losing the $30 million we've been getting. Let's try and make some other better deals. You know, like I feel like they're not – it was money they never had, so they're not registering it in that way.
I suppose, but I think, you know what I mean? I think it's foolish because if you basically – here's the difference between Starz
and HBO. But they may have a plan.
But here's the difference between Starz and an HBO or Showtime, right? If you basically – if I have Netflix and I say I pay $8 for my streaming. If I pay $10, I get access to HBO programming. I'm in. Showtime original programming?
Yeah.
I'm in.
Right.
Because totally. I want Dexter. I want, you know, True Blood. I want Boardwalk Empire. I want Game of Thrones.
That's for their original content.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's what you really have to – you know, these cable – you know, people like Starz, people like HBO and Showtime. That's really what they have to offer. I don't care enough about what was the show? Spartacus?
Spartacus. Oh, it was a huge show.
And did well, but it's one show and I don't care enough to really go and pay extra for that. Starz is not in that league.
No, no.
But if an HBO or Showtime did that, I would totally be down. And that's where I think they're maybe making a misstep. Their original programming is not that interesting. People can go and get their, you know, their basically, you know, they're not syndicated, but you know, the movie that they're redistributing for other companies, those Disney movies, all those kind of things, you can get that elsewhere. You can get that direct. The only thing they have complete control over themselves is their original programming. I think that's where we're going to see these content.
But they do have
kind of, you know, these cable companies as content creators really go and have some legs to stand on.
I mean, right now the big leverage they have is they do have a good window. They've negotiated a great window for themselves for these first run movies. I mean, if you ever look at the Starz movies that on your cable or satellite, they have however they ended up getting it originally, they have a really nice position for first run movies on Starz.
Right.
That's their biggest advantage. Of all of the stuff. They don't have the original content library yet. And it looks like they're working to get it, and maybe they will.
Well, I think they have to. I think all these premium channels, I think that's where they realize they have to – that's where they can go and, you know, create their own long-term value.
You know,
otherwise, they're just middlemen.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's true. I'm curious if they're shopping around, you know, if Starz is shopping around to other – to Hulu, to Apple, to who, yeah. You know.
And if they're smart, they would be going to Amazon and Hulu. Yeah, exactly.
Maybe they are going to, but you know, Amazon doesn't need them, to be honest.
Amazon.
They need first run movies, but they don't need them, I don't think, to do it.
I think Amazon.
That's what I mean. Like,
I think their best shot is with Amazon because they think they could go and really, Amazon's in a place where they want to have as much content as possible.
But it, like you said, like even the first run movies and a lot of the stuff on there, the quality was not great for the Starz stuff. And all the stuff on Amazon is high quality stuff, you know, and they're making deals. Amazon currently is already making deals directly with the content providers. I mean, their huge CBS deal, they have all the Star Trek series now on there. I mean, like they've made some in the past 6 months, Amazon has made some huge deals.
Well, setting the stage for this, you know, this
that's what I mean.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, if you look just in the past 2 months, the amount of content on instant streaming on Amazon has like tripled.
Yeah.
There's tons and tons of stuff on there now.
And we say Star Trek, we mean all Star Trek.
Every series.
Trek Enterprise, which you probably don't want to watch, but it's
but
there.
Every episode of every series, that's
right.
That's a big
it's
deal with CBS
content.
Media that they made. I mean, that's a huge, huge deal. So,
yeah. So it's interesting. There's so many, almost, this is such a volatile space right now, but it's really, really exciting. I can't help but think that, you know, eventually, Netflix will replace that content with something else because they are putting all their eggs in that basket.
They really, you know, it was interesting when the comment came out from Hastings about how much what percentage was Starz in the streaming.
Oh, this was fascinating.
Realm.
Yeah. They said it was
like 8%.
Yeah, it's a huge part of their catalog, but it's only 8% of actual usage.
Which made me think that people are not streaming movies because.
I think people are streaming movies. I think people just aren't streaming. I think people have burned out on the crap content. Because what you talk about when you talk about Netflix is like you want to see a great first run movie. It's not there. I think they are in the danger of getting into a position where the most desirable movies aren't there. So I think them losing, you know, maybe they
but they're not only losing the crap, they're losing the desirable stuff too. They're losing.
Yeah, but I think all their movies. for whatever the reason, I think they can afford to lose that because it's such a small part of, you know, what they're getting. If they can go and take that money and then go and get, you know, premium deals with some other, you know, distributor to get better content, that's a net plus for them.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just saying, like, it's just saying now, like, I think 8% was a telling number to me because you say people don't want the crap content means majority of their streaming, I think, is coming from TV.
I'd be very curious. I don't personally watch any TV on Netflix.
I mean, most people I know are TV. Even DVD rentals. Most people these days, and it didn't start off that way, but most people I know are TV on Netflix. Even the DVDs, they're getting seasons of TV. Like that's what everybody talks about. You know, did you watch this season of blah blah blah? Did you watch that season? You know, I'm curious where they're going to end up, because they're obviously right now scrambling for these deals. They're not showing it, but they are doing it.
I mean, I think they're always scrambling for more content. I think the way they responded to this, I still honestly think that this entire thing is still negotiation and pressure, because, you know, it's Netflix coming out and saying, we don't need you. It's only 8%, basically says, hey, guess what? You're not worth that much. You know, them, you know, basically, you know, Stars coming out with this. Well, here's the telling thing is Netflix
pulled the plug when they asked for that ridiculous premium.
Well, apparently they were ready to go. Well, I think they've been offering
Except for that was
the final sticking point. And I think, you know,
stupid.
Well, Stars coming out and saying well, they're coming out and saying, you know, OK, cool. You know, we don't, you know, we're done with you, Netflix, to kind of get Netflix to go and give. Right. And then Netflix says, guess what? You're 8%. We don't really need you.
Yeah.
And we know what happens with, you know, internally within all these companies. I would not be surprised actually if this deal does renew before February already, because it's happening. This is all being discussed about 6 months out.
Maybe they don't want it to.
I think they'd like it. I think they'd like to have it if it's going to be at a reasonable price point. You know, more content doesn't hurt Netflix. You know, they can never have too much content.
True, but they could, like you said, have better content.
Yeah, of course.
You know, I mean, it's weird because I always think of on the streaming side, you know. Stars help build the catalog for Netflix.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, like without that, they would have had, you know, very little, if anything. Like that was a great move on Netflix's part in both of their parts, really, in the beginning.
Yeah. No, I mean, it was such a cheap deal, too. It was kind of like
nobody knew.
It's a sweetheart deal where nobody – they kind of give it away because you don't realize it's going to become the behemoth that it is. It's, you know, it's the licensing deal with, you know, with Star Wars basically all over again, right?
Yeah.
It's like, okay, we don't – sure, take that. Action figures, whatever. We don't care. And it can end up being this big thing. But I do think, you know
– I think it is clear
that Stars is overreaching a bit, and we'll see what happens.
Yeah. I do have to say, like, this is the second – renegotiation they did with Stars, right?
I don't know, actually.
And I think Stars ate it.
I feel like this is the first one still, but
then it's been going on for a really long time.
I think so, yeah.
Okay, yeah, because I mean it always seemed like Stars was getting the bad part of this deal, but now that, you know, when it all said and done, it came out that they were offering $300 million and then Stars wanted this extra fee.
Well, that to me is like, and honestly, all this stuff is that, you know, the spokespeople for each company are talking to the press.
And there's some truth in both sides.
Yeah, so there's obviously going to be nuance that's not involved. But this on its face, you know, okay, you want a premium Stars tier, really? Like, you're being ridiculous.
That is ridiculous.
Yeah.
That is ridiculous.
Yeah, so we'll see what happens. Like I said, I still think they want the content. If Netflix said, you know what, the way that was released, I think Netflix's position probably is like, we want the 300, you're not getting a special tier, take it or leave it. Yeah. And this, you know, their response release was just, you know, basically putting that out there.
Yeah.
I think that's a reasonable position. I'm sure inside Stars, many people are going to be like, well, that's fine.
I'm curious how this price increase is going to affect Netflix over the next couple months. Because of even with Stars, the amount of streaming content on the movie side kind of blows.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I think that they want to move all their customers to streaming. So
I know that's what they want to do, but it's like,
but I don't think they need
the content
move.
To do that.
I don't think they would make the move unless the numbers on their side backed it up. If they thought it was going to, they needed a couple more years to pull the trigger on this shift, I think they would wait a couple of years. There's no real push for them to go and do that. I mean, they have some deals, you know, up for, you know, renegotiation, obviously. And I think having more subscribers on streaming only,
but,
may
just
help them.
I wonder if
way.
Maybe they're underestimating the other markets out there, because with
it
this Amazon
be.
Device that comes out all of a sudden,
it could be.
And instant streaming all of a sudden gets better movies and makes great deals. Wow, that's a pretty viable alternative to Netflix.
Yeah.
Streaming.
Definitely.
Because they don't have a hard DVD business. And, you know, so.
And what is the, right now, Amazon offers. If you have, Amazon Prime, what does it offer? Is it it's just streaming
full,
only, right?
Full streaming, instant streaming.
But that's they've been adding some stuff. What is, you know, what their current title count is at? Because it was really, really low.
No, but
the
they've been like multiplying like crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they've been doubling content and just like, it started off so and just getting more and more and more and more and more.
And also, I wonder how long until we see a Netflix app for Amazon Kindle.
Well, interesting. Probably, maybe never.
Why not?
I don't know.
You don't think Amazon would approve it?
No.
Really?
Why would they?
That's going to be very interesting, too.
Like, why would they? I wouldn't.
Well,
if I was Amazon.
Well, you know why? Because it basically makes their app store, makes developers, you know, not want to go and pursue their app store. Because they've already been kind of busted for having policies that have been even more draconian than Apple.
I mean, I guess Netflix, though, would have to develop an app specifically for the Amazon tablet. And are they going to want to do that?
I think they want to go and, you know.
Because will the regular one work on there? Because it doesn't, the Netflix one does not work on all devices currently.
Well, I think it's actually easier for Netflix at that point. They don't have to worry about supporting 10 different, you know, Android tablets with different form factors and resolutions. They can just go and hit one.
And you think it would be the Amazon one?
I think the Amazon one is going to be the number two tablet.
Probably.
In a year. So, like, they want to have their product on all successful platforms.
If I was Amazon, I wouldn't allow it.
It's interesting. It's going to be very curious to see. And this is a whole other conversation we'll get into over the coming year, I'm sure. But how Amazon's app store takes off with this device. I feel that that is one area where they do not have guaranteed success.
I don't think it's going to be huge. I don't think that's the draw for that device.
I agree.
Or
the
future of it.
I think people will go and it'll be there. But
it'll
I think it'll be
people a handful
a failure,
apps every
but,
now and then maybe,
yeah.
You know, but it's not going to be, that's not going to be a money-making behemoth like it is for
They'll
iTunes.
Have like, you know what I see? I see big name partners like Angry Birds, you'll have that on there.
Yeah, there'll be a couple of.
And maybe, you know, EA goes and makes some games for it. Once again, because it's relatively cheap for them because it's, you know, one platform, one size, one screen resolution.
I mean, maybe we're wrong. I don't know, but I don't think so either.
I think the audience is going to be very different. You know, I think it's going to come down to iPad being the high-end device with applications and Kindle for just, you know, media consumption.
Right.
Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah. We're getting listeners in the chat room.
As it gets later in the
Exactly. Talking about our early start time.
Sorry.
We got to
do what we
got
to do.
Show's got to go on.
The show has got to go on. We got the commitment here. That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
So as a real quick aside, we talked about the touchpad the last few weeks. HP this week announced that they're going to go and be manufacturing another round of touchpads to get out to consumers, and they'll be coming out in the coming weeks, which was really weird.
It was very weird.
Yeah.
It's very strange.
Lots of speculation. Are they trying to go and, you know, like build up the install base to make it more attractive for licensing or purchasing? And, you know, it comes, you know, a couple articles recently, it basically comes down to what you'd said earlier, Scott. They have a lot of
components.
They have a lot of component suppliers that are just kind of like pissed that, you know, they have all these parts. Because like they were getting ready to do the touchpad 7-inch as well.
Right.
And they're just like waiting around. So I think they're having to do that just to go and, you know, because they do have that hardware business still. It's not it's not gone yet.
No.
They're talking about doing something
that's scaling
up, but it's still there. They have to have their component suppliers be happy people with them.
Yes. And I feel in my gut that that's pretty much the only reason they're doing this.
Yeah. Because still like, you know, every device is still, you know, hundreds of dollars lost for them.
Yeah. So. Yeah. This is a long-term strategy that has nothing to do with bringing the touchpad back or any.
And by long-term like strategy, we really mean just get rid of everything at as little loss
clear,
as we
clean
can.
House.
Yeah.
Clean house. So we don't have anything left.
Yeah.
Oh, jeez.
Moving
on to, by the way, this is, I think, the longest in the show we've gone before we talked about an Apple product. Brian's normally, Apple. No, I'm just kidding. There's been so much Apple news that.
Interesting stuff. There's a, you know, this morning or yesterday morning, there was a leak from Best Buy, actually.
Yes.
Best Buy employee.
I think it was this morning.
Yeah. the 21st of October, there's going to be an Apple installation, quote unquote, being installed at stores at 6 a.m. So managers got to get to the store at 6 a.m. for something. Now, if you've been to a Best Buy, you know that they have displays for the iPad,
kiosks,
and all that kind of stuff. So
their whole Apple area that they have.
So people are saying this is probably going to be some sort of display unit for the iPhone 5 or the iPhone 5 and 4S or whatever coming out. And you know, the release has always been said it was going to be mid to late October. So either this is, you know, when it goes live in Best Buy, or it goes, you know, this is a Friday, I think, the 21st. So
makes
that's
sense.
Some clues to what's going to be happening. We're obviously in September now, and there's been no announcement in terms of, you know, press event yet.
Right, right.
So we are looking later and later as we go on. Also, iTunes Match, which is the, you know, the very, very, you know, if everybody's very curious about it, the music service, how it's going to work.
Our lovely friend Ryan.
Yes, it launched on beta this week. So it's very, very interesting. It was open to the beta for a number of hours, and then they took
not
it down.
Not long at all.
So like developers could basically download a special build of iTunes, turn it on, and then after like a couple hours, if you tried to do it, basically said like, hey, we're closed for now, check back later, and people couldn't get in at all.
And it wasn't a free – like it was the – you had to purchase
you had to purchase the service, but you got the entire beta period for free, and also you got an extra 3 months free.
Yeah, that was
so
nice.
Which is kind of cool. Yeah. It's interesting. It shows a lot of promise. It's very, very clearly early beta stage, right?
Yeah. Through how like it actually, you know, works from the start.
Yeah, apparently. I mean,
from what we've heard,
right? You launch the new build of iTunes, and underneath, right near the Genius thing in a menu, there's a turn on Apple Match, and so you turn it on, and then you have to go and, you know, do the subscription thing if you want to join. But it basically goes and, you know, uses Genius, basically already goes and scans your entire library to figure out your tastes and help build stuff, you know, give you suggestions and stuff.
Right, right.
I feel like it uses that. It's building on that.
Makes sense.
You know, finish the scanning your library, uploads that data to Apple, and it basically it goes through all your tracks and matches them with what Apple has in their catalog. It was very, very interesting because you wonder if you go and change the metadata, you know, the sorting information, how is it going to know which songs are which? There are a lot of songs that don't match correctly from what I understand. Also, is that because it's still new? You know, you don't know. And the matching process is very, very, you know, beta still. Like it will go halfway through, then restart and that kind of thing.
Right.
And then after it goes through that second step, it'll go through and upload all the songs from your catalog that it does not have, you know, in the iTunes library. And then basically you go into your iOS device or a different version of iTunes and you turn on Match there. And then all that stuff just shows up on your device.
Now, that's awesome.
And what's really interesting.
That's awesome. And that's also – I'm tooting our own horn this whole show.
This is what we wanted.
This is what we wanted and what we predicted months ago. Sorry. we're on the cutting edge here.
Scott is very humble.
Hey, listen, I just, you know, we've been doing the show long enough that it's cool to actually see some of the stuff we've talked about actually start to come to fruition because it validates us a little bit.
Well, I think it's just exciting to see the stuff that you hope for make it to market.
Yeah,
you know?
That's true.
But it's very cool. But it's interesting is it actually takes over your entire library on your iOS device. So if you turn it on,
it's not in a separate area.
Correct. It basically is. Can you click the music, you know, application? That's all your stuff there.
So it's not like when you have home sharing and you see another computer
and there's a different library.
And there's a different library. This is all contained in your main library.
Correct. So as a user, it is just one, you know, application with all of your music available.
That's
and there's
neat.
No differentiation between, you know, downloaded or cloud or anything like that. And they've at first it came out and it had streaming. Which we didn't know if it was going to have streaming. That was the
right,
big question we've
right.
talked about. And was like, well, looks like they're going to have streaming. And it was like this big deal. It worked with Playlist. It was very, very cool. The next day, beta 7 of iOS 5 came out. And that changed it slightly to something that Apple is calling progressive download. And what it is now is you can obviously go and download the tracks manually or download an album from your cloud like you already could with previous purchases, right?
Right.
What you do now, though, if you want to go and stream a track, you press play. And as well as playing it downloads it to your device in the background. So conceivably, if you just get a new device and you want to listen to Appetite for Destruction because it's the best rock record of the last 30 years, you can just start playing Welcome to the Jungle. It will download that, and then it will download every consecutive track off that album while you go, or a playlist or whatever it is, so to make sure you have it ready to go, and then it keeps it. So if you go back to that album, you never need to go and, you know, download
it again. That's the thing. Does it keep it forever?
Yes. It's now in your local library.
So here's the thing, though. What conceivably could happen – which there's got to be a way that they're doing that's maybe not implemented yet, is that you could fill up without realizing it.
You could, yeah.
Which you're not going to want to do. So I feel like – I wonder if there'll be a setting where you can say only download my last 50 songs or only – you know.
Yeah, I don't know. There's got to be something. You can also – I mean you can delete stuff from local storage, which you could never do. I don't think you could do before in iOS.
No, you couldn't.
But now you can, and then you could just restream it if you wanted to. What I like about it conceptually is that – it takes the notion of downloading or pinning, you know, on the Google Music Player side of all this kind of stuff out of the equation. You don't have to worry about what is local, what is downloaded. It's just your music, and you can access everything you want whenever. Like you said, there's an implementation question about, you know, what if you have more music than your device has room for? And I don't know how they, you know, what their plan is for that. Maybe they have data that says, you know, most people have 6 gigs of music, so it doesn't matter. People like you and I have, you know, tons of music, like, you know, tens of gigs of music. You know, I think I have like 30 some, right?
Right.
Or actually, I think I have 60.
Right.
Much more than my 32 gig device, you know, can hold, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And like that becomes a problem if you want to have all that. But at the same time, I don't listen to all my stuff. And I bet what my normal stuff I actually listen to is probably a lot smaller. So I think in normal practical usage, it never shows up for people.
Well, I think
I'm sure they have data to back that up before they make the move. You know?
I'm sure they do. You know, on the Google beta music player on the Android phones, they do something similar. When you start playing it, it does download. It's the same thing. It's progressive download. It's the same thing. I read about it, but also I know it, like, I've lost connection and I'm still listening to two songs. I'm like, okay, obviously. but what it does is it keeps, and I don't know the exact algorithm they use, but it keeps your most recent and most played songs downloaded. And it's all in one user interface and whatever. But it doesn't like automatically save when you play. I feel like Apple's got to do something similar.
Well,
they have to. It makes sense.
Yeah, and it could be like, you know, they keep everything for a month and then they queue it out, because if you haven't listened to it in a month, then it doesn't matter.
Right. Then
it doesn't
matter.
And there's also, you know,
it'd be nice if there was a setting. Like, well, that would be cool if there was actual like on off.
I don't want a setting. See,
but like say always keep it or don't. You know, like,
well, see, I think get rid of the setting completely, right? Because just adds complexity, right? What you do is you basically if they can determine what you listen to most often, because here's one thing too, they can tell. On iTunes, they track when you skip a track. So they are already keeping within your iTunes Genius library your listening habits.
Right.
So if they have that information, they can basically, you know, determine, okay, cool, if you listen to this song, you know, 4 times in a month, maybe we're going to keep it. Or if you listen to it once and it's been 30 days, then you can dump it safely, because you can always get access to it back, right?
Sure.
I think that's really, really interesting. I like it where you don't have a setting, where it's just music.
The default would be that. And then if you knew to go in and look at the settings, Apple has that a lot in the iPhone. There's a lot of settings that most people don't ever look at and know about.
Very true.
So why not, you know, have it in there for the power user?
Yeah. Or maybe it's a situation where if you manually download it. Here's what I can see them doing. If you manually download it, even that situation, there's no way to go and there's no differentiation between that either. I don't know. It's going to be very curious to see how it ends up working.
Able to say my music library is limited to a certain amount of gigs. Because then, like, what happens
that,
is
that makes sense to me.
You know what I mean? Because if you fill up, then you can't take pictures and you can't get emails. It doesn't make sense for it to just download everything till it fills up.
Well, you know what it probably is?
It's
probably just like it is with, you know, memory usage on devices in general, right? If you can have – you have 10 apps open, when you run out of memory, it starts killing off those old apps.
Oh, that's interesting. So it just starts removing music to free up space on stuff you haven't manually downloaded.
Because that's the dream, right?
That kind of makes sense.
Because then it basically is – it's just
that makes,
multitasking
that makes
for your
a lot
music,
of sense.
Right?
Yeah. That's totally what it is. That's very interesting.
And then you never have to worry about it. If you listen to it regularly, it's going to be there. That makes sense.
That makes total sense. So I'm curious to see as this beta progresses, because this is a first beta run at this thing.
I mean, like I said, it's been closed now for 4 or 5 days, and it is still from all accounts. And if you have a developer account and look into the boards, it is, you know, people being upset and angry. And it's very funny too. If you look into those developer boards, there are a lot of people that clearly are not developers that have developer accounts to get software early who are complaining about beta software being
not working
beta
right.
behavior. And it's like, that's the way it works, guys.
That's beta. Yeah. That's what it's for.
But I guess that's the what happens when you have a $99 beta program and they can get stuff early. Right.
Now, the other thing that had been noticed was where they're storing this music. I thought this was
yes.
The streaming.
iCloud in general, right?
This surprised the hell out of me.
You know, they have this huge data center. Everybody assumed it was going to be for iCloud, but Apple's not really known for making, you know, that kind of, you know, building that kind of infrastructure in the past. MobileMe has had many problems, right?
Right.
And so there have been some articles, and I noticed it as well. The servers that it was loading, iTunes was loading my iCloud music to, were Amazon AWS servers. And apparently,
amazing.
Article came out earlier, over the weekend. They're basically using a combo of Microsoft Azure.
And AWS.
And Amazon services. And striping between for redundancy and protection and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, that's cool, but it just really surprised the hell out of me.
And I don't know if they're going to be using those in conjunction with their services. And they're kind of going, you know, which would make sense. But they got to use the data center for something, right?
Yeah. And maybe it's not for storage like that, though. Maybe it's just...
Or maybe they use, you know, Amazon, you know, for the moment they're using that for upload, and then it, you know, goes to, you know, maybe, you know, the North Carolina data center is where iCloud lives, but all these are other intermediaries, or I don't know. Like, it's...
I mean, or possible that that's currently where iTunes stores their libraries, where that's the iTunes
not,
store.
That's definitely not true. Because I know they're on, what is it?
No?
That's definitely not the case, though.
Just the main store where you download from?
Correct. That is not Amazon.
No? So, well, then they had to have moved it all over.
Well, this is where you go and upload your own personal music. It's not where it's putting the match date. It's where it's uploading your songs.
So the stuff that is on Amazon, I mean, that's matched, is pulling from somewhere else?
That I don't know, but I know when it's uploading.
That would be strange.
When it's uploading your own personal music, it's uploading to AWS
service.
Like,
you know what I'm saying? Like, that wouldn't, if it was stored in two places, that means it would have to, if you had two songs, one that you owned, one that you didn't, in an album, you would be playing one, it would be reaching to Amazon, then you'd be playing the next one, it would be reaching to Apple.
Yeah,
it's strange.
Maybe. I don't know.
For that
I don't know.
To be the case. I mean, where do you know that? Had you read somewhere that the iTunes stores are stored somewhere, like on Apple's own servers?
I think they've just been around before Amazon's web services were even available.
Well, I wonder if they've like moved some of their stuff there. I'm curious. I mean, we can find out at some point. You know what I mean? And it's something. The weird part about it is it's something I'd actually never thought about.
Because I think Apple's always used, is it Akamai? Is that how you pronounce it? I feel like they've always used them for all their, you know. Mm-hmm. It's all, you're always connecting to their servers, and you're trying to go and get something from Apple. In the past, at least,
yeah.
I need to go and, you know, I should.
And
check
I mean, I'm sure, like the, you know, Apple.com and like their downloads and stuff aren't stored at Amazon. But
right.
I wonder if the music store has.
Yeah,
been.
I don't know, or maybe like the iCloud component of it. I'm sure there's going to be lots of information coming out soon about this. But just the fact
that they're not using the data center is what everybody thought.
At least not directly, yeah.
Yeah, it's weird.
Yeah, so we'll see. And it's obviously Apple using Microsoft products as well. And, you know, and how are they going to be using – there's a great article we'll link to it in the show notes about what that means. Would they be using, you know, different kinds of servers? Then, you know, Apple could be using, you know, Microsoft, you know –
maybe they're going to use all
software
of them.
On, you know, Amazon servers. So it's really kind of – it's very interesting.
I mean, and maybe that they're going to be using their own also.
Yeah.
I mean, it could be, you know, having multiple redundancies and running it off Amazon, their own, Microsoft's.
Because
good
they know
for them. Great.
Because they know
something
they're
going
to be. Down. Yeah, because they know they can. They're going to have, as we talked about this, they're going to have, you know, a very short time to sell this service. It has to work perfectly out of the gate, or it is going to be, you know, dead in the water.
Right.
They have
because
no room for
error. If this thing comes out buggy, they got big problems.
Yeah. It has to launch and be perfect.
Right. It does.
It's funny. There's always like, oh no, Amazon's using Microsoft. It's like this big thing.
No,
and
not
it's
big,
like,
big, use just
what,
interesting.
Yeah. It's like, use what works.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I don't think it's telling in any way, shape, or form. I just think it is.
Well, you know that they're
unexpected.
You know,
because of the whole data
to make
center
that a
stuff.
Story. People are waiting to make that a story.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Totally.
Apple uses Amazon, uses
Microsoft.
You know,
oh no.
Come on.
It's like Apple using Samsung memory. It's like, yes.
And using Toshiba hard drives and you,
Yes.
They do all that. They don't make their own glass. They don't make their own aluminum.
So here's the Apple aluminum.
Oh my God.
Facility.
They use tin aluminum from the UK.
The UK makes terrible aluminum.
Yeah, they really do.
Excuse me. They make terrible aluminium.
Aluminium.
Anyway, and real quick aside, there's some weird – this is a developing story. There's not a lot to talk about it now, but news broke late last week that Apple had lost another iPhone prototype in another bar in San Francisco.
So weird.
And then the day after, it was like, oh, it's very interesting. And CNET broke all this stuff.
This was all just weird.
Very, very strange. And basically, they lost another phone. They tracked it to some person's house. Apparently, Apple investigators went to check it out. And it seemed kind of dicey. Then they said, no, the police were with them, SFPD. And then they said, no, SFPD said, no, we don't have a record of that. Then SFPD came back and said, oh, yes, we are. We did again. And
yeah, well, that was the weird thing. Like, the reporters called SFPD and they denied it.
And they had no record of it.
I was like, what? And then, then the next day they said, oh, yeah, we did. And then the report came out that, oh, well, they went to the house, but they never entered. And like, there was all this weird,
strange. And they tracked it down. The lead guy basically that went into the house to search for this device did, you know.
They didn't find it. Right?
They did not find the device.
Yeah.
But this guy is employed by Apple, according to LinkedIn. So very, very
just sketchy.
Suspect. Yeah.
On everyone's part.
Yeah.
Everyone. Both sides.
From Apple to the cops
to the guy
who says he didn't have it. It's all very, very
sketchy.
Sketchy. Yeah, that is the word.
You know, and it seems like the SFPD has been sketchy about this kind of stuff. Like, why? I mean, they're not going to ruin the relationship with Apple by being honest. So why are they being sketchy?
Yeah, I don't want to go and, you know,
I don't understand.
Try to go and come up with scenarios about what may or may have happened, you know, allegedly and that kind of stuff. But it just seems, you know, so we'll just wait for the story to go and, you know.
But just because of all the misinformation, I mean, obviously SFPD was saying that they weren't involved. Like, why that was ever. Why they even ever thought they needed to cover up something that probably didn't need to be covered up. That's my whole point.
Or why was there not a formal record of it? You know what I mean? Once again, we don't want to speculate, but
weirdness.
Weird.
Yeah.
Weirdness.
Yeah. Very. Yeah.
And then I got to be honest. Like, you know, I love Apple's products as much as anybody, but if there's anything sketchy like that, that is just not okay.
No.
You know, that kind of stuff is not okay.
No, it's not.
So
they got to control their products, man.
Yeah. So, well, a lot of people are wondering, like, when the SFPD said there's no net record of it, it's like, is this just like a weird viral marketing campaign?
Right. But again, they lost the.
But it's not a good one for Apple.
No,
it makes their engineers look terrible.
Yeah. I don't think it is. I think it's just. I'm curious to see when the final story comes out.
If it does.
Well, if it ever does. Yeah. Although I think a lot of these tech reporters are hungry for this story now because. Of the if they hadn't denied it and they just said yeah, it would have been kind of a dead story.
Yeah, just be like that thing happened.
And be like, okay, whatever, big deal. Who cares?
It's always the cover up that gets you. Rarely the crime.
Exactly.
There you go. Cool. Well, should we move on to food?
I think we should move on to food.
All right. Well, you take the lead on this.
Oh, I take the lead. But this was your. This was your.
But it's the food. So you take the lead.
Okay. So what is today?
Friday night.
What the hell is today? It's so early. It's Sunday, yeah?
It's Sunday. We normally record on Saturday. It's
okay. On Friday night was Brian's
birthday. It was Thursday night.
Stop doing that. It was Brian's birthday.
It was indeed.
So happy birthday to Brian.
Thank you, Scotty.
He is 24.
but a worldly 24. A worldly man.
He's not. It was so Brian's birthday. We went out to a restaurant here that was one after my own heart.
And we talked about it before.
We
wanting to go there.
This place called Masa in Echo Park out here in Los Angeles that has Chicago style deep dish pizza.
Yeah.
And it has been claimed by this restaurant and many people I've talked to have been there that outside of Chicago, this is definitely one of the best Chicago deep dish pizzas that you can get. So I was very excited to try this place. Neither Brian and I had been there before. I actually had been there for lunch, but I didn't have the pizza.
Actually, I've been there once before as well, and I had the sausage. But
oh, you
I had
did?
Not, but
okay.
I not had the pepperoni, so which is my touchstone from childhood of Chicago deep dish pizza, even though it's not traditional.
Right. So I have to say they did a great job. You know, admirable try.
And Scott, of course, will never give – after his Chicago pizza episode, will never give true props to anybody outside of his hometown.
But I will say – so a couple of things about this pizza. First of all, these pizzas were massively huge. We had 10-piece massive, huge – it was ridiculous.
And we got
leftovers.
Yeah, we got a sausage. We had a pepperoni. We had a vegetable. Veggie. And then a vegan option they also offer too, which is pretty unique and which was supposedly very, very good.
Yeah, I didn't taste it, but it looked really good.
Yeah.
You know, and it was cool. They had actually a really nice big vegan menu there, which was neat.
And the whole – and also I also had a gnocchi dish that was incredible. The whole menu, everybody had anything.
Everything.
Really,
yeah.
Really loved it.
Yes, so this place was fun. It was cool. We had great service. The food was delicious. So on the pizza front – for me, the traditional Chicago pizza is sausage pizza. They're on their menu, they're traditional with sausage and mushroom. I have never seen that as a traditional Chicago pizza on any menu in Chicago, but they called it their traditional. I don't know why the mushroom was thrown in. I mean, it's probably good, but it was weird that was like the traditional.
And if any of you are from Chicago and know the Chicago, the sausage and mushroom are to be the traditional, please let us know.
Yeah, because I've never seen it. Not that it's not an option. It's always an option. So we got the sausage and I tried it.
And tell a little bit about, you know, because when I had it, you know, a couple months ago, I was very, very surprised at the way the sausage, you know, integrated into the pizza.
Well, I think I talked about it on the other podcast, but it's a smashed sausage and it's like a layer, basically a whole layer of sausage on the pizza. And then cheese below and on top in this deep pie.
Yeah, and whole pear tomatoes.
Yeah, and whole tomatoes garlic and everything. And, yeah, it's a really unique thing. But so, you know, this looked like a Chicago pizza. It was served in a deep dish. It smelled great.
It was ginormous. Yeah.
It was huge. I tasted it. It was very, very good. I'll go my little differences to me, what I noticed. So on the crust side, because crust on Chicago pizza is very unique, they nailed the flavor of the crust. The taste of the crust was dead on. The consistency was a little different. And I'm not sure why, what mm-hmm. made that difference, but it was a little fluffier. And in Chicago, the crust is usually a little crispier.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, to be honest, I think it's just the way you put it in the pan and the way you pull it up. Cause like, and obviously you guys can't see what I'm, so I'll try to describe it, but
he's gesticulating wildly.
they push the dough down on the bottom of the pan and then they pull it up on the sides.
Right.
So it kind of makes like these rounded edges, almost like a pie crust, uh-huh. Coming up. And this looked just like more like a puffed up pizza crust on the outside. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
So I just think it's in the preparation.
Sure.
But the taste of the crust, they nailed it.
And if you've never had this before, it is flaky and buttery. And it's much, like you said, it's very much more like a pie crust than a traditional pizza crust.
Very much so. So cheese was great. The tomatoes were amazing on the pizza.
Yeah.
I mean, they really just killed it. And then the sausage. The sausage I thought was great. It was really good, but it was different. Taste-wise than what I normally get in Chicago. There was a lot of, I believe it was fennel in the sausage, and it's a very strong taste if you have a lot of it. And I think for me personally, it was a little overwhelming. It was an overwhelming flavor that if that was toned down just a bit, it would have made a big difference. But all in all, it was great. I'll definitely go back. I think anywhere I've been, not just Los Angeles, out of Chicago, this is definitely the best deep dish I've tried outside of Chicago. So wow. I will throw it up there.
Heady praise.
Yeah, no, it was good. They did, and I'll tell you if the sausage was just a little less of that fennel flavor,
mm-hmm.
It would have been so, you know. Just like right there.
Yeah, I've had the sausage, like I said, a couple months ago, and I'm usually not a sausage, you know, pizza person at least.
Yeah.
And it was delicious and wonderful. And it is overwhelming though, like you said.
It's a very strong flavor.
And because it is that big, you know, like, you know, layering of
it's
sausage.
It's a layer. It's not sausage pieces.
Yeah,
it's smashed casing inside. I mean, the casing, smashed flat and layered on top of the pizza.
Basically, just imagine a pie with like, you know, a huge layer, round layer of sausage just put on top.
Right. Yeah, that's what it is.
And I had Chicago pizza. Here's my story of Chicago pizza, right? Years ago when I was growing up, in Dublin, California, of all places, there was this Chicago pizza place that a friend turned me on to. And I was young. I had to be like, you know, 13, 14, right?
Yeah.
And I was a big fan of pizza in general. Round Table was my pizza of choice at the time, my chain of choice. And it turned me on to this place. So I went to go and check it out. And it blew my mind. I'm a big fan of garlic. I'm a big fan of pepperoni. I'm a big fan of, you know. And basically, this was the best pizza I had ever had in my life. You know, and obviously as I get older, it has like, you know, the love and glow of youth around it. So it makes it even better.
Nostalgia.
Yeah. And I've had, you know, Chicago pizza, you know, pepperoni Chicago pizza since, and nothing's really quite matched it. I've had, you know, was it Lou
Malnati's?
I've had that, you know, flown out, you know, mm-hmm. friends have been wonderful mm-hmm. enough to go and like, you know, send it to me for on birthdays and whatnot and dry ice. And I go and I warm it up and it's delicious, but it's not the same thing. It doesn't match what I had in my head when I was a kid for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. You know, it's hard to know as a kid. You just remember like the flavors.
Yeah, right.
There's like just something specific.
It's a sense memory.
Yeah.
And you just, when it hits, it hits.
Yeah, and you can't, you know, pick out what it was because
right.
you're so young.
Just something about it.
Yeah. And so had this pizza, and it was literally like I went back, you know, 20 years in time, right?
That's awesome.
It blew my mind. There's like something about the sweetness of those tomatoes balanced with the saltiness of the pepperoni and the way it all gets wrapped up in that crust, which is so unique. And I got to say, it's one of the best things for me. It was one of the most amazing, delicious things I've had in 20 years. Like, it just made me happy.
That's so cool.
To eat it. It was so delicious and so wonderful. Like, the way that crust works, that flaky crust just sets everything off in such a different way.
Yeah, the crust is great.
And you actually want to eat it with a knife and fork. I hate eating pizza with a knife and fork.
No, you have to eat it with a knife and fork.
You need to, because you need to go and get all the flavors in one piece. And it has like this thick layer of cheese that just, you know, holds everything together. And like, when you get that one bite with all the different layers, like the sauce and the tomatoes on top, then you get the pepperoni and everything in one bite. It is so unique and so incredible. It's just a fantastic, you know, experience. And the restaurant overall is just, like you said, it's so much fun. The servers are
great. It's a great restaurant. Everything
really,
about
really
it.
Fun vibe. We had like a lot of, you know, not a lot of people. We had like a decent sized party and like, you know, and my friend's, you know, son. And so it was like a lot of stuff, but it was great. The servers were fantastic. These great, like, you know, checkered tablecloths on top of everything.
And very eclectic kind of restaurant.
Just really, really fun. And there's also, like I said, like this great gnocchi I had with, you know, cream sauce and peas and bacon that was just fantastic.
Oh,
and
yeah. We had good appetizers, a good spinach artichoke dip.
Our friend had a great burger that he was like raving about.
They do, just a quick aside, it's a burger with chorizo in it.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, it's actually kind of insane.
Did you taste it?
I've been there before. Yeah. Okay. Oh, my God. It's awesome.
And so it was just this really, really great time. And I cannot recommend this restaurant highly enough just at that point.
Masa Echo Park.
Yeah. Mm-mm-mm. But then it came time for dessert.
Yeah. So if everything we had eaten already wasn't good enough.
Yeah, it already would have been like the highest thumbs up possible.
Meal.
And it's a great night.
Here comes the birthday candle in this amazing dessert.
Yeah. Now, what my amazing, my amazing friends ordered for me was called a warm croissant bread pudding. Now, it looks just like, it looked like a combination of an apple pie and a bread pudding. I didn't quite know what it was before, at first, right?
Kind of came in a slice.
Yeah. And what it basically is, it's basically they take, chocolate almond and butter croissants and they pan bake them. And then they basically put in vanilla custard and drizzle with like, caramel sauce and there's chocolate in there. And
talking dirty to me, Brian.
And it was just, oh my God. It was just like,
melt in your mouth. It was melt in your mouth.
Yeah.
Like you would take a bite of this and it just kind of dissolved in this sugary bliss.
And it's a mixture of textures. There's like, there's what you normally see of it, like as the bread pudding, like that really kind of like, gooey, thing, plus with the caramel. And then like
you got like the flaky and you got the gooey and you got
and
everything.
Then the, and then like the chocolate croissant seemed to be in the bottom so it hit you last. It was like this incredible like, group of flavors. It was just stunning.
Well done. I mean, using the croissants as the base for the bread pudding, I've never had that before. And I'm going back for that.
Yeah. And we passed around the table a number of times. It was just fantastic.
And Brian and I were the ones that were like digging out every last morsel of it.
I think like, let's offer some. You want some? They say no.
No,
like,
no. Oh, okay. Cool.
Yeah. Good. Like, I'm glad you had a taste and have your fill. And I'm also glad you don't want any more. So that means we get to have more.
Yeah.
But it was fantastic. And, I just wanted to thank everybody at Masa. I want to thank Natasha. I want to thank you, Scotty, and everybody that was there that night. It was just a really, really fun time. And thanks to all you guys. It was awesome.
Oh, you're welcome. No, it was a great time. It was a good choice. Good choice.
Yeah. So Masa of Echo Park, highly rate it. We'll put a link to the restaurant in show notes. You can see pictures of the pizza there.
Yeah.
And I don't think they do the mail out thing. I don't think they do the shipping thing.
No, they don't. You can do Lou Malnati's from anywhere in the country. We'll put a link to that too.
Yeah. But if you're ever in LA and are inclined
and
to
are
all,
hankering for
or
Chicago
even if you're just
style
curious
pizza, or actually just want a good restaurant, to be honest with you, I got to tell you, just a good casual place with high quality food and cool people.
And it's a cool area. I mean, I love that area of town over there too. It's really, really fun.
Yeah.
So yeah, highly recommended. Check it out.
Yes.
Cool. So you have anything else this week?
No. Okay. I did have another food thing I was going to talk about, but this trumps it. So I went to Morton's for dinner last week and just had some steak and it was great.
Morton's good.
Yeah. Always good. Classic. Always good. But this was a better story.
Yeah. This is another level. So anybody, thanks for joining us this week.
On our early morning Sunday holiday weekend broadcast.
Yeah, props to Dan for actually listening in. We're impressed.
Yeah. Thanks, brother.
Yeah. if you like the show, tell your friends and family, leave us some reviews on iTunes. It's a great way for people to learn about the show and get people more people discovering it.
You can, contact us on Twitter. I'm at Scotty G7.
I'm at BC Bishop and I can't talk.
See, you flubbed it this morning. Every other week. I'm
It's still early.
This is a weird morning. Let me tell you, ladies and gentlemen,
it is still early.
I am Scott.
I'm Brian. Take care.